Hello, you're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. I'm Kate Andrews, Associate Director at the IEA. This week, the UK rolled out the red carpet for Donald Trump's first state visit. This controversial president shows an above 75% disapproval rating among the UK. But forget about the politics, what about the policies behind this visit? What is the status of the special relationship? Can a UK-US free trade deal really be secured? If it were, would the NHS really be put on the table? And what about the economic debates taking place back in America right now? Joining me today to discuss this is Tim Stanley. Tim is a historian and leader writer for the Daily Telegraph. Also joining me is Freddie Gray, deputy editor of The Spectator, who edits Spectator USA. Tim, tell me what you made of Trump's state visit overall.
It went very well. That sounds ridiculous because before he had even landed, he got into an argument with the mayor of London, although it's worth pointing out that Sadiq Khan started it.
He did. Twitter.
But crucially, this wasn't a personal visit. This was a state visit, and therefore I felt it had a different tone to the previous diplomatic venture, actually. And I think the president got it pretty much right. This was about the commemoration of D-Day. This was about solidifying the alliance. And of course, it comes at a moment in which Britain is hoping to build some sort of post-Brexit transatlantic economic and political relationship. So actually, the vibe out of this visit was pretty good.
Freddie, do you give the same rather glowing review?
I do. I think very glowing, actually. And I think Trump behaved pretty well all round. And I think the Twitter spat was a low moment. I'd also like to say that the British media, I thought, behaved quite well. There wasn't the usual sort of very obvious anti-Trumpism everywhere. And there was a sort of, you know, the BBC kicks into gear when it's a state visit occasion. And there was a sort of, there was a seriousness about the media that I think a lot of American commentators were quite surprised by.
Yeah, it seems like it may have played well with his base at home because actually it was taken very seriously. And all the stops were pulled out, weren't they?
Well, yes. And I mean, he got what he wanted, which is all the photo ops. Not all of them. Because the younger royals seemed to be quite keen to show a little bit of distance. But certainly the Trump family, I mean, one does wonder quite why all the children are there sometimes. But, I mean, it was a nice occasion. And even though I'm a disgusting old cynic, I'm quite pro these things.
Well, you know, I think it goes unappreciated just how much Americans look over to the UK, especially these days, and just look in awe. Between the royal babies, the state visit, you know, there's a real love in the US, I think, for the royal family that is often underappreciated. But Tim, well, it was a state visit. It wasn't all pomp and circumstance, was it? There were serious discussions about the potential around a US-UK free trade deal. Do you think there are benefits to securing that kind of deal? And if so, how do we start to craft a language to get around the opposition to it?
Until we know what will actually be in this trade deal, it's very difficult to talk in terms of economic benefits. Right now, I have to say, all I'm hearing is the negative stuff, what the impact will be upon agriculture. You know, my mum is a great barometer, and she said to me the other day, I don't eat a chlorinated chicken. I had a big argument with her because I said, why? She couldn't explain why. I don't know. I mean, it sounds like it's been swimming in a public bath. So that's what sounds bad to me about chlorinated chicken. But I don't quite know what's wrong.
I like it when people call it pink slime. So, like, what is chicken anyway? I mean, it's always looked like pink slime to me.
There may
before it's
well,
cooked, definitely. Yeah.
There could be economic benefits, but part of the problem is that they may even be invisible to a lot of British people. For instance, it would be fantastic to get access to the American banking market and financial market. If we could get HSBC and NatWest opening branches in Kansas and Minnesota, that'd be fantastic. I don't know if the Americans would even allow that. But the problem is we probably wouldn't see that. So economically, it's very limited right now because we're just not talking about it. But politically, for good or ill, it's become very important. It's become a barometer of Brexit's success. Brexit really is about existential concepts like freedom and sovereignty. But in the last few years, politicians have tried to add on sort of Christmas tree baubles that give the impression of material benefits. And the Tories have jumped upon this idea of a US trade deal as being a benchmark of Brexit's actually delivering something for us. It's not just all about sacrifice and risk. So it's become politically very important. And the good news is that this administration is very much in favor of it. The bad news is the Democrats now control the House, and they're going to be attaching lots of riders to any trade deal. And there's been noises, for instance, around the backstop and Northern Ireland. That's a big part of American politics, the Irish-American thing. So it's going to be tricky to get it signed off on. Good news, administration for it. Bad news, politically it's going
to
be difficult.
We'll come back to the Democrats in 2020 in a minute. We've seen different estimates from $14 billion to $40 billion of increased trade between the US and the UK if they were able to get a free trade deal. How do we go about convincing people that things like chlorinated chicken, which even the EU says isn't dangerous and they're not that fearful of, could actually prove beneficial to their lives? It's about bringing down costs for consumers. It's about giving them more choice.
Well, I think we need to get away from the kind of parochialism of a lot of Westminster politics. It turned into a row about the NHS. I mean, we managed to turn anything into a row about the NHS. And the funniest part of that is that Trump just didn't know what the NHS... He clearly didn't know what the NHS was. And he said, yeah, sure, absolutely. NHS is on the table in a trade deal. Not realising the sort of unbelievable furies he'd unleash. Actually, on the left and the right, you know, so the right immediately starts saying, well, why can't we open up the NHS to American competition?
Well, some on the right, I mean, I saw quite a few of the leadership candidates come out and be very, very clear that the NHS would not be a part of a US-UK free trade deal.
It's the line you cannot cross.
You cannot cross it.
Even if it makes perfect sense to cross it, you can't cross it. But Britain should be able to think more open-mindedly and more dynamically about these things. But unfortunately, we can't, because it becomes a sort of, you know, anti-American. And you know, there would be concerns about the NHS and how we would protect it in a free trade deal. But the point is, we're not even close to that yet. So why we can't talk about these things is interesting.
We're not close to it, Freddie. And as well, if the US puts something like the NHS on the table, the UK can take it off the table. This concept of no deal is better than a bad deal applies just as much to the US as it does to the EU.
It's red lines again. It's Theresa May's red line style strategy. If you begin the trade talks by saying, this is what we will not do. And of course, that's not how you open trade talks. As you say, you put literally everything on the table. And as Nigel Farage said the other day, if there's something you don't like about it, you don't sign the deal. There's this strange misunderstanding that you have to, this is what's going to happen. Well, no, if the negotiations went wrong, you don't sign it. As with the withdrawal agreement, you don't like the backstop, you don't sign the deal.
Mm-hmm. Freddie?
Well, I think, again, there's this sort of nervousness in Westminster and a kind of lack of faith in Britain, really. I mean, I think there's a wider sense that Britain can't actually manage on its own and that we would get these decisions wrong. We would be bullied by America. And, you know, we wouldn't have Europe to protect us from the sort of invasive forces of American capitalism. And, of course, that's just not true. Other countries do it. We could do it too.
I agree it's not true, but to play devil's advocate, and actually maybe even to highlight a very real concern, the current US president is very America first. He is a protectionist, he loves tariffs, and he falls in and out of favor with people very, very easily, really at the whim of a tweet. So, Tim, is it worth pursuing a free trade deal with this US president? Surely, yes, he is saying he'd like a free trade deal, he's putting it on the table, but is it actually going to go well during the negotiation process?
That's a reasonable question. There was a controversy over aircraft manufacturing, wasn't there, from Northern Ireland?
Yes, there was.
The US administration obviously did not support Canada's position. That affected Northern Ireland, I think. So undeniably, that's going to happen. That's, again, the nature of trade negotiations. It just means you have to play exactly the same game. And we've not been doing this for 40 or 50 years. Mm-hmm. This is part. I agree with Freddie. It's about a lack of confidence in Britain, but it's also about a lack of confidence in themselves. Because the governing class of this country for 40, 50 years, as we've discovered since Brexit, has not been doing a lot of stuff. It's been told to do it instead, and it's been implementing it, usually with a perverse, almost kinky kind of enthusiasm. But it's not really been making the decisions themselves. And they haven't got the confidence to enter those negotiations. If they do, I damn well hope they involve private sector people, and it's not all done by civil servants.
And also, it's worth just thinking intelligently about Trump's position. I mean, we know he needs farming support, farming votes, in fact, next year. And so, therefore, we have leverage, to use the Trumpian, one of Trump's favourite words. I mean, we have leverage in the way that Trump wants access, American access for agricultural exports to Europe. And that is a huge advantage in our position as Brexit Britain. We can show what you can do with American agriculture and push Europe into a different position, and Trump will be willing to negotiate on that. So we just need to think intelligent. Of course he's capricious, and of course he's, you know, could go off and on things. But I'd say one thing he's been amazingly consistent about is his enthusiasm for Britain, based on all the sentimental personal stuff, and also his enthusiasm for Brexit. And his enthusiasm for Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson.
He's got a lot of enthusiasm for Brexit. One must wonder if that's because he claims he predicted it, having just come out to support it, but days before it actually happened.
This is what I love about Donald Trump. It's that he will go to his grave believing that he came to Britain the day before Brexit and predicted it happened. No one dares say to his face, "You're wrong. It was the day after."
He also considers himself to be at least half British. He really does
because of his mother.
Yes, and the journalist David Graham once put it very well that Trump is a man without a country because he's not really welcome in New York.
Not anymore, anyway.
No, his family for a long time pretended that his father's family were from Sweden rather than Germany. I can't blame them for that. So he is really, if he's anything, he's Scottish because that's where his mother came from and she spoke Gaelic as a first language. And he has often said, "I feel Scottish." I mean, that's partly a business thing because he wants to own two golf courses there. But he does feel British and he does respect the royal family and he is into the pageantry. We are a former imperial power welcoming the current imperial power. And it's fascinating to see that dynamic. We are the model in many ways of what America would like to be.
It is fascinating. While Britain may be feeling slightly intimidated as it ventures back onto the world stage on its own, it is very ambitious to go for a free trade deal with the superpower of the world first. You could try to get that template in Japan or New Zealand, but the UK is going for America. So, you know, that actually is quite impressive.
Yes, well, again, I'd say look at the leverage. You know, look at if we can get something done quickly with America, there is leverage in it for Trump in that he can then use it in the ways he's trying to renegotiate tariffs with China, Europe, and Latin America.
So to move a bit to domestic policy in the US, Freddie, I know you spent a lot of time there earlier this year and last year. And it's fascinating for me, originally from America, to look at the state of institutions there. Because on the one hand, we see a lot of discussion now around the checks and balances on Donald Trump's power. But as well, we're seeing, you know, even just talks over this past week about potential impeachment from the Democrats and how institutions may be used by some would argue against a president who has a Democratic mandate. I don't think this started under Trump. It started really under Bill Clinton. And there have been issues with executive power and checks and balances under George W. Bush and Barack Obama. But how do you think the state of institutions is in the U.S. right now? And is it worrying from sort of a civil liberties perspective? Are they corroding or is it just a storm in a teacup?
It's a difficult question. I think they are. I think the checks and balances of the Constitution are amazingly durable. I'm not a great American constitutionalist or anything like that. But I do think it is impressive how America has survived the expansion of the executive, the expansion of the imperial. We now have an imperial presidency, as Tim was suggesting. And yet there are checks and balances within the Constitution that mean that Donald Trump can't wreck America. You know, and actually Barack Obama can't wreck America. But I think American institutions are durable. And in fact, you are becoming traditionalists about certain things. Like, it's interesting that how heated the Supreme Court decisions and nominations are now. Why has that become so important now? I think it's because there's a growing sense that they have to preserve the order of America because you might be an imperial power in decline.
Preserving power, yes. And Tim, maybe some of it has to do with the fact that government and its decisions play an ever-growing part in our daily lives. And people are worried that the Supreme Court, which, you know, if it's balanced one way or the other, can make huge decisions about what people can and cannot do and what they choose to uphold. People actually feel like, oh, it's not just a decision being made from on high anymore. It can actually affect my life.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's always been the case, I have to say. I mean, you go right back to Dred Scott and Brown versus Board. The Supreme Court's role in the history of slavery and desegregation shows it's always played that kind of role. And of course, in the 1930s, the Supreme Court tended then to be very conservative and tried to overturn a lot of the New Deal programs. So FDR cooked up this idea of flooding the court with members. So I personally argue it's always been that way, but I agree with Freddie, in recent years, it's become so heavily political because there is this sense of a balance that's about to tip. And the interesting thing historically, if you can stand back and be very objective about it, is will Trump pull that off? Will he pull off at the same time as it feels as if American society is trending towards becoming more liberal? Will he actually pull off correcting that in the institutions to give it a conservative bias? And the great test of that is going to be the abortion laws currently passing through various southern state houses. That my suspicion is that even the conservative Supreme Court justices are going to want to not touch those and are not going to want to tear up Roe v. Wade and are not going to want to go near abortion just yet. Because even those who are being handed this institutional power, I suspect, are nervous about the consequences of using it. But yes, there is a huge battle. It's that tipping point theory. It's about conservatives taking over the institutions and fighting back. And the big challenge, therefore, conservatives will face is, and there's actually a whole debate going on online about this at the moment, though it can seem rather esoteric, but there is this huge debate among conservatives. Do we use the power of the state? Do we do what liberals have been doing for 30 or 40 years? And do we say, not let's demolish all these institutions, not let's cut back their power, but let's actually use them to our own advantage? And again, you can see the abortion debate at the very heart of that. Surely classical liberals, when they take control of things, should be limiting the influence of the state. But in that case, they've decided, no, I'm actually going to use the power of the state to frame policy.
It's fascinating to look at it in that way, of course, because if you're constantly giving power back, if you're lucky enough to, you know, be in the position to do so, but your opponent's going to try to grow it, well, sometimes you can only fight power with power, can't you, Freddie?
Well, yes, and I think this is this debate that Tim was referring to that I think strikes any British people seeing it online as slightly odd, because it's become this war between two actually still quite obscure American journalists, David French and Sohrab Ahmari. Am I pronouncing Ahmari's name right?
Yes.
And I mean, that is fascinating. But what I think it boils down to actually is it's those guys are thinking about 2020 and they're thinking, how big on Trump do we go? Because for Ahmari, it's Trump is our, you know, it's the cudgel with which we can fight back excessive liberalism or sort of extremist liberalism. Whereas for French, you know, it's all about you have to stay within the orders of the Constitution, within the orders of individual liberty. And so that is the great tension on the right. And it's always been the tension on the right. And it was kind of disguised for a long time through this fusionism of libertarianism with, Tim's a great expert on this, he's going to have to correct me, with libertarianism with kind of old conservatism. And now Trump has sort of blown that all away. And what do you have left behind? What is conservatism now? Is it a more protectionist, a more statist form of conservatism? Or is Trump actually just moving America away from what is correct and what is conservative?
For the sake of the listeners on the podcast, we're definitely using liberalism in the sense of the American term.
Yes,
but we
yes.
are talking about American politics. That's very important. Well, Freddie, that takes us on nicely to my last question for you both. As we move towards 2020, and you know the media in America is already kicking up a frenzy around an election that still, I would like to think, is quite far away because not all of us have recovered from 2016. you know, in the age of Trump, we are seeing that rise of populist tendency, and the Democrats are lurching to the left, especially around economic policy, talking about big tax hikes, talking about much more regulation coming in, bigger crackdowns, especially around the environment, say, on flight travel or consumption of meat, thinking specifically about the Green New Deal. So, Freddie, I'm not asking for a prediction, but how do you think the economic debate is going to play out in America between Democrats on the further left and Republicans on Trump's right? And are they going to talk about the economics, or is it going to be all about personality?
Well, I think we've heard so much on all sorts of channels about this, you know, the radical left in America. But actually, I mean, look at Biden. He's soaring away in the polls,
but
right?
Bernie Sanders is catching up to him.
Bernie Sanders
recent
is catching
one.
Up a little bit. But Bernie's been there since 2016. It's not a new thing that necessarily. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of Biden's appeal is that he's not really, you know, he's not woke in any way. He doesn't go in for, and every time he does, everybody knows he's such a phony that he doesn't really mean it anyway. So he feels like a conventional Democrat. And that is appealing to a lot of the people who voted for Trump. And they will go to Biden. So I think if Biden carries on with this, unless he manages to mess it up completely, which is very possible, I mean, I think you may see a more conventional Democratic candidate, but not quite in the Clinton mold, more in the fake blue-collar mold of Joe Biden.
But that doesn't necessarily mean, certainly doesn't mean Bill Clinton economics, does it? He was relatively free market. It could be a bit more protectionist like Donald Trump to bring back those voters.
I think he'd hint in that direction. I don't know if he'd really go there.
He wouldn't go Trump.
I mean, I suppose Warren's economic populism came out today. What did she call her zone? It was nationalism, It was something, it even had the word national economics.
She's calling it economic nationalism.
Economic nationalism,
which
right.
is a terrifying phrase which from a classically liberal
well,
perspective.
Exactly, but that's a total play for Trump's yes, base. And that is very interesting.
Which she won't win.
Which she won't win. Because,
Tim, give us your prediction.
I think Freddie's spot on. I often think about it in terms of past races. And to me, Biden is a sort of Walter Mondale figure. He is the party that wants to feel good about itself. That they're still debating what went wrong in 2016. And there's a tension between should we be like Trump and be radical class warriors, but from the left, or should we be like Clinton was and be moderate and just try and win back everyone who has just exhausted with this presidency? And so Biden seems like a safe bet in that sense. The alternative is Sanders, the more radical candidate, or Warren, or someone like that. He can play the class war. The really interesting outside, I still think it's Pete Buttigieg, who does represent a generational change in the way that he talks and his manner, and this fact that he is gay and married. The only thing is, I think if I think of it in terms of past races, he is so eerily similar to Mike Dukakis. I think Pete Buttigieg is the Dukakis of 2020, in as much as basically nice, very good temperament, incredibly intelligent, but woefully boring and doesn't stand for anything at all. And the public will initially think, fascinating, I like you, you're different. And then they'll start to think, but what do you actually think about anything? So this is the problem with the Democrats, is they still haven't come up with a strategy to deal with Trump. But having said all of that, if you look at the polls, it's Biden. And the thing about polls is we keep saying polls get it wrong. They do, but very often polls are right at the start. Mm-hmm. They just then go wrong during the race. But often what you begin with, like Trump leading the pack in about, autumn of 2015, very often that's what ends up happening.
He was leading the pack. And I think if Brexit and the Brexit Party and Donald Trump teach us anything, it's that more and more the public likes an opinion. They actually like people to take a stance on something.
You have to give people a clear choice. Yes. And that's something that the Tories in this country don't understand. And they are taking the path of least decision making.
And we can only hope, Freddie, that in the near future, perhaps somebody will take a stand for freer markets and freer people, which sadly I do think is gaining less and less traction in our public debate.
Well, perhaps we just need to come up with slightly more creative ways of selling the free market, in fact, and maybe even operating the free market. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you both very much for joining me. You can download more podcasts if you subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations.